In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about torture. When we think of it, to the extent that we do, I'm sure that most people think that anyone capable of torturing another human being must himself be inhuman. However, our guest for this part of Focus, journalist John Conroy, says there is more than ample evidence that most torturers are in fact normal people, and for many perpetrators, torture is just a job and nothing more. That comes from his book, Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. It's not a new book. It came out first in 2000. It is available now in a paperback edition published by the University of California Press. So if you'd like to seek it out, certainly you can find it. The reason that we decided we'd like to give John Conroy a call is that this book was sitting on our shelf, and we think that the subject is timely right at the moment. Unfortunately, we find it something that's timely on a fairly regular basis. And we'd like you to have the opportunity to hear what he has to say and discuss some of the ideas in the book. So, indeed, the book is available in paperback, University of California Press. I think that first came out in 2001. John Conroy is a staff writer for the Chicago Reader. He is author of another book about Ireland titled Belfast Diary, War as a Way of Life. And also his work has appeared in a number of other places, including the New York Times, Washington Post, the Boston Globe, and the Chicago Tribune, including other publications. And he lives in the Chicago area, and he's joining us by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Mr. Conroy, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm good.
Good. Thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The book, maybe we should explain a little bit, has three case studies which exemplify what we're talking about. And at the same time, in the introduction to the book, you give a caveat because you say it's not – the intention of the book is not to do something – encyclopedic necessarily, and that one could definitely take issue with the various places that you write about, Northern Ireland, Israel, and Chicago. And, you know, people, if they have, you know, particular axes to grind, will find it an occasion to do that. And maybe that's understandable. But maybe you could talk a little bit about what you set out to do. How it is that you, and I know, for example, with the Chicago case, that was a story, this is a story of torture at the hands of police. It was something that you had written about a lot, and you also wrote about Northern Ireland, so maybe it was natural that you should write about those places. But maybe you could talk a little bit about how it is you picked these three instances to concentrate on, and then overall, what it is that you hope to accomplish.
Well, that's a good question, David. I set out... When the idea for this book first came to me, Ann Close, an editor at Knopf, had read my first book, and she wanted to do a book on torture and didn't know quite what would be in it. She wanted to do something, and I was interested in working with Knopf and with her. I thought the book on torture might be too painful for people to read, but I decided I'd look into it, and the more I looked into it, the more interested I got in torturers. And I thought, as I talked to my friends and people I met, that most people, as you say, think torturers are monsters of some other species. And so I thought what I would do would be to choose three case studies in which the American reader would identify with the torturer. It's not that difficult, I think, in many cases to identify with the victim, but it's much harder to put yourself in the shoes of the perpetrator in torture. And so I chose these three case studies. The first one from Northern Ireland involves a case of 14 men who were tortured by the British in 1971. And the attraction to this case was that I was writing this book. I started in late 1980s, and I thought that I could track these guys down 20 years afterward and find out what had happened to them. And what made it interesting, that particular group, was that ordinarily torturers do something different to different people, so that if you come in, you might get electric shock, and if your sister is brought in, she might be sexually abused, and if your grandfather is brought in, his arms and legs might be attacked, and, you know, different things can happen. But with these 14 men, the British security forces tortured them all simultaneously. Well, they tortured 12 simultaneously and two later, but they used the same method. The men were from the same socioeconomic group. There were a variety of ages involved, but nonetheless, it was in some ways a control group of torture victims. You could track these guys down after 20 years and find out what had happened to them, and the techniques that had been chosen were designed to attack the mind as well as the body, and so I could find out exactly how this played out over time. The men were subjected to what was known as the five techniques. They were hooded, they were deprived of food, they were deprived of sleep, they were forced to stand in painful positions on the wall, and they were bombarded with noise. When they fell off the wall, they were then beaten, so that would actually be a sixth technique, and they were also denied access to any toilet facilities, so there's a humiliation aspect as well to this. And so I was able to find the ones who were living and talk to most of them. A couple of them didn't want to talk to me, and some of them I had to talk to their widows or offspring because they were dead. The second case is a case in Israel of a colonel who ordered his men to break the arms and legs of some Palestinians during the Intifada. And this is in 1988. And I was attracted to this case because there was no question that it had happened. The men who carried out the order had stood up in court and said they had done it. So I thought that I could find the perpetrators, because they had been named and had admitted what they had done, because they had testified against the colonel who gave the order. And then I could possibly find the Palestinians whose arms and legs had been broken. And so I set about doing that. And that case was really about obedience to authority. The men who got this order, the captain in particular, who got the order from the colonel, knew it was wrong, and he couldn't carry out the order himself. And in fact, it was done on two nights in two villages, and on the second night he had the bus driver rev the engine of the bus so he couldn't hear the screams of the men whose arms and legs were being broken. They were being broken, and then they were left in a field where it was hoped that someone would come and rescue them, or that one of the men would. It was supposed to be a system designed so that one man would just have his arms broken so that he'd be able to get up and walk for help. So that was the second case. It was really about how we as human beings respond when someone in authority gives us an order. And the last case in Chicago involves a police commander named John Burge, who from probably 1973 through 1991 was head of a unit that tortured suspects using electric shock and suffocation and hanging people by handcuffs, burning people a few times, and severe beatings. And that case interested me for several reasons. One, it was in my hometown. But two, it really gets to the nature of what we mean when those of us who say we're against torture, what that means. Because I think in many cases what it means is that we're against the torture of people we like. The man who was really in many ways responsible for exposing this torture was a man who had shot dead two policemen. His name was Andrew Wilson. And after he was arrested, he was at large for about 5 days, arrested by Commander Burge without firing a shot and brought into the police station. And when he emerged from the police station, he had these strange marks on his ears that looked like a little alligator had come up and bit him. And he said that alligator clips that had been attached to his ears, that he'd been shocked with a hand crank device and also with a something that might perhaps have been a cattle prod. And he'd been shocked on his ears and nose, his fingers, and his genitals. And he told this story in 1982, and nobody really paid much attention to it because here was this guy who was a career criminal, and he, you know, he was convicted of the murder of these two cops. There's no question he did murder the two cops, and he was given the death penalty. But then the Supreme Court of Illinois threw out his case, saying that the state hadn't proved that his confession had been given voluntarily, and he was retried again without his confession, convicted, and given a life sentence. So he persisted in his civil suit and in 1980 against the police department, saying he'd been tortured. And in 1989, that came to trial. And during that trial, anonymous letters started arriving at the offices of Andrew Wilson's attorneys that said that these machines had been used before. These letters, by the way, arrived in police department envelopes. And the writer clearly knew a lot about the this particular unit, was able to name people who participated and also people who didn't. And he directed the Wilson's attorneys to talk to a man named Melvin Jones, who was then in Cook County Jail. And when they talked to Jones, Jones said the same thing had happened to him 5 days, it turned out 5 days before Wilson back in 1982. And he'd said that back in 1982, and when they pulled the transcript, there it was, and Jones was asked, well, what did Commander Byrd say to you when this was going on? And he said, and Jones replied, well, he asked if I knew Satan and Cochise, and I said I knew who they were, but I didn't know them well. And he said, well, they were crawling on the floor when I did this to them. So the attorneys then went and found Satan and Cochise, and sure enough, they knew all about it and knew other people who'd been tortured. Satan was one of them with electric shock, and so this list started to build of men who had been tortured by this unit, and as a result, we now have a special prosecutor investigating it, although it's 30 years after the first instance of, or the first allegations. It is nonetheless the first time that the police are actually being investigated. Hmm. So those are the three case studies. In between them, I talk to, there's a chapter on history and method. There's a chapter on torturers, in which I go around the world and I talk to torturers from different nations. And then there's a chapter on victims and a chapter on bystanders, why torturers are rarely punished. And that's the book.
Yeah. I have a caller here, and I promise I'm not going to make them too much longer. But to follow up on the sort of the first set of questions that you talked about, during this period that we've been in that we call the War on Terror, and that we've had American troops in Afghanistan and in Iraq, there has been now some discussion about what techniques are appropriate to use in interrogation, and the ruling seems to be that it's acceptable to subject people to extreme forms of stress, say, for example, sleep deprivation, but that there is some kind of a line somewhere that when you cross it, you go from allowable techniques to what generally would be considered to be torture. And there seems to be one of the questions that people seem to wrestle with is, where is that line? Given the fact that you've thought about this and written about these instances, do you think that it's difficult, or is it not difficult to decide is something torture or is it not?
Well, I think it's extremely difficult because sometimes what's torture to one person is not torture to somebody else. If I put some people in a room full of, in a cell full of snakes, they would be driven mad, and other people enjoy snakes and wouldn't have any problem with that. So different things affect different people in different ways, and so when you start talking about how much sleep deprivation can we inflict on this person without him going mad, or suffering some sort of permanent mental disability because of the combination of sleep deprivation and stress, that's going to depend on the individual. And so it's extremely difficult to sort of draw that line.
Well, let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. He's John Conroy. He's a staff writer for the Chicago Reader, has reported on Northern Ireland, and has written a book about that titled Belfast Diary, War as a Way of Life. More recently, Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. That was a book that first came out, I believe, in 2000, and now is still available. It's available in paperback. It's published by the University of California Press, if you'd like to read it. 333-9455 for people here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to be involved in the conversation. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's our caller, line one, Champaign. Hello.
Yes. I was wondering, in doing your research, if you ever looked back at a writer called France Fanon, who wrote a book called Wretched of the Earth. I think it was published in the 60s, but he went back and talked about his experience living in Algeria and being a psychoanalyst, and later joining the Algerian Liberation Front in its war against France. But he observed victims of torture, or he had them as patients, and he also treated a torturer. And this Frenchman who was forced to torture people or brought into this system of torture was very affected by being a torturer, and it was affecting his relationships with his family and with his children and with his wife. And he was becoming very, very irritable and short-tempered and violent, and seemed to lose all control and all patience with his family members, especially his children. Did you look at the trauma or the effects of being a torturer on torturers? And why are they never brought to justice?
Well, two questions there. The first one, in terms of the trauma, I did look at that. There's a woman in Greece named Mika Haritos Fatouros, a psychologist, who has studied the Greek torturers, and she concluded that after the junta had fallen and and the torturers had gone back to their villages and resumed normal lives, that they went on to live perfectly normal lives. There was no evidence of any kind of sadism in their life beforehand and none afterwards. And I would say that of the torturers whom I met, and I can't say that this is a scientific sample because I was only able to meet ones who would talk to me, and they may be of a certain, no scientist would say that's a scientific sample. None of them claim to be abusing their families or anything like that. However, some of them were isolated politically because of what they had done. Some of them had come forward to testify about the torture, and as a result, they were no longer embraced by the people with whom they had served, nor were they embraced by the people who had been tortured because they had once been torturers themselves. So they were, one of them, for instance, an Uruguayan was living in a small town in Sweden, small city in Sweden, I should say, and, he may have been the only Uruguayan in that city, and he told me he couldn't go home, and he had people with whom he associated, but he had no friends. But, I don't know that was a sort of result of his actions. It's not a result of his internal agony over what he had done.
So,
what was your second question?
Why
are torturers rarely punished? They're rarely punished because there's a few things that happen, but one is that the torturer says, "Wait a minute, I was only following orders," and as you trace the orders up the chain of command, they get more and more vague, and people say, "Wait, I didn't say that. I said this. I didn't say that." Or there is nothing. So then the people at the bottom who did the torture are portrayed as scapegoats for the high command, and And for a war policy. This is why in the Vietnam War, when the My Lai massacre was exposed, you had people from the right who embraced Lieutenant Kelly, saying he was a good soldier doing his job, and then you had people from the left who said, poor Kelly, he was carrying out Westmoreland's war of attrition, which was based on body counts, and he's being made the price to pay the price for what was essentially government policy. So he was embraced by elements of the left and elements of the right. And the same thing happens in other torture situations where you get the guys on the bottom who are being asked to pay the price. So that's one thing. The other thing is that the people who are tortured are usually an outgroup in the society. They're people with whom we have no sympathy. They're beyond the pale of our compassion, and so the society really doesn't care very much. If you look at what's happened in Chicago, and I think this is a very good example, we have men in Illinois now who are serving very long sentences, life terms, some of them, for crimes they confess to under torture. Now, there is no mass movement in Chicago or Illinois to reopen their cases. They're all fighting them individually, one by one. No government official has been appointed to review all of the cases that came through that were touched by these torturing detectives. So we frankly don't have any idea how many people were tortured by the Chicago police. It could be 110, it could be 650, it could be 1,500. We have no idea. But there is no clamor here to reopen and to just wipe the slate clean and give these guys new trials, and it's in part because they're from the outgroup. They're all African American. Many of them have criminal records. They're accused of heinous crimes, and so they rot away in jail. Some of them for crimes they may not have committed.
Well, it seems like Kerry is still being outed for having talked about some of the massacres and torture that went on in Vietnam, and he's. The power structure is trying to out him for his past speech on that topic. So what do you think about the whole Abu Ghraib thing and Rumsfeld? To me, I mean, he already sent out the message long before Abu Ghraib that torture was all right. I mean, that's the message he was saying, when we're going to take these people to other Arab countries and they know how to get these people to talk, which is basically what he said in news conferences.
Yes, I would agree that there was a tone set at the top in Guantanamo that carried over into Iraq, and that anyone who might be thinking about using methods that wouldn't be allowed in the United States on prisoners here, mass murderers, multiple murderers, serial killers, they aren't subject to these methods, but we might suggest them to civilians over there who haven't been charged or convicted of anything. And I think that decision, if the interrogator sitting there with somebody in front of him is going to make that decision, knows what the climate is. And if the climate is one of tolerance for abuse, then there will be abuse. If the climate is one of intolerance for abuse, there won't be abuse.
About a month ago, there was an article in the New York Review of Books that basically defended torture as a necessary aspect of getting information quickly, and it went back and talked about the Algerian situation. Did you happen to see that article?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. Well, do you think that torture is a necessary evil, or that it is an effective method?
Well, I have no doubt that torture produces information. People talk when they are tortured to stop the torture, and they'll say anything, and that's why it's an unreliable source of information, because people will say whatever they think, whatever they can think of, if they think it will stop the torture. The other problem with using torture to get information is, one of the other problems, is that When I torture you, and it becomes public, as it, you know, always does, your brother and cousin and sister join the resistance, and my people who are captured by your people are then going to be subjected to the same, you know, who will say, well, no, we shouldn't torture them because they treat our prisoners over on the other side so well. It also exists, you know, when in Vietnam, when soldiers were, after about 1968, I might be wrong on the date, everybody who was ground forces in Vietnam was given a pocket card, which said "the enemy in your hands," and it was guidelines for treating the enemy. And it made the point that if you abuse suspects, that the other forces will fight to the death rather than surrender because they know they will be tortured. And they will inflict far more casualties than if they think they're going to be treated fairly if they give up. So when you embark on a course of torture, you are embarking on a real slippery slope that's going to cost you a whole lot more than you're probably bargaining for.
As the caller sort of suggests, the people speaking for those individuals who have been charged in the Abu Ghraib situation have said that these individuals, the soldiers, believed that they were doing what they were supposed to be doing, that they had permission to do that, they were being encouraged to do that. The response of the military, on the other hand, has been the bad apple response, saying, well, no, there was no encouragement of this. People weren't ordered to do this. What we have here is a handful of individuals that are essentially bad people, that they just decided to do this. Given, again, the fact that you've thought about this and talked to some people who were torturers and looked at the subject, I guess what I wonder what you think about the bad apple defense and whether that seems to make sense, the idea that you could have a situation here where you just happen to have in this place people who are sadistic psychopaths who take it upon themselves to torment the people that are in their custody.
I think that's possible in any sort of incarceration situation. You can have bad apples who can go haywire. I don't think that happened in Abu Ghraib. I think that you had in Abu Ghraib some people who I think were bad apples. You know, I think someone who is a clerk who comes over to hang out with her boyfriend and ends up standing on people's fingers and walking people around on a leash, that's not a... I don't think she has a defense for saying that she was ordered to do it by military intelligence. But I think that the context of the situation was such that we are arresting people, and the Red Cross estimated that 80 or 90% of these people were innocent. So we've picked up these people in sweeps, we've stripped them of their clothes, and now they are being held and interrogated late at night. And it's a situation that, you know, is ripe for disaster. And so I think that you can't argue that it was a few bad apples. I think more to the point is that you've created a situation in which this sort of behavior doesn't seem far-fetched to the people who indulge in it, because they're already in a place where bizarre things are being allowed.
We have other callers. Let's go to Champagne, line 2 for the next. Hello.
Hi. I just have one question. I have not read the book, by the way. But anyway, my question is, do you think there is pleasure? Is there evidence that there is pleasure? As a nurse, I know about the pain-pleasure concept. But in torturing people, do you think there is pleasure? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Well, hang on. Before you hang up, tell me about the plain pain-pleasure concept.
Yeah. Well, the concept is that if it doesn't create pain, for example, when you're exercising a muscle, you exercise to the point of pain. Mm-hmm. That's a concept really simply stated. So I wonder if...
Well, I think in the torture situation, what I think of in terms of the... any pleasure would more be a the torturers who spoke to me about it talked about doing a good job. They thought that they were doing a job that the most people they knew about it would appreciate them defending the nation and they were on the front lines in this battle against subversion and so they were doing their job, trying to do it well. And some of them said to me, you know, there's nothing personal, you know. And I remember a guy named Hugo Garcia, an Uruguayan, saying to me, you know, there's nothing personal. In fact, when we were finished torching him, we often used our own money to go and buy him a hamburger or a pack of cigarettes or something. And it wasn't a hamburger. I can't remember what it, but you get the idea. And so I think that there's a feeling of power as well that's, you know, I would think somewhat intoxicating when you have complete power over a human being. You can do whatever you want with them. I think that can come into play here.
Do you think it's naive to expect the best? I mean, I tend to be naive. I found this shocking. I wouldn't torture anybody.
Well, that's what most people think. But placed in the situation, you know the Stanley Milgram experiments?
Yes.
Well, I'll explain it for the listeners who don't. In the early 1960s, Stanley Milgram, a professor at Yale, devised a series of experiments in which he recruited volunteers who were told that they were participating in an experiment to test the effects of punishment on learning. And the volunteers came to an office where they were led into a room and seated at an instrument panel. They were told that the switches on the panel generated electric shocks ranging on the left from very mild shock to the far right, which was severe, dangerous shock. And there was another volunteer, it was actually a confederate of the experimenters, who was the learner, and the real volunteer was the teacher. And so the teacher was to ask questions, and when the learner got a question wrong, he was given an electric shock, and the teacher was to proceed all the way up the scale. Until the experiment ended. And what Milgram found was that more than 60% of the people will go all the way to the end of the scale as long as there's an authority figure there saying the experiment must continue. And they do this even though the person receiving the shock is begging for mercy, pleading seemingly for their lives, people will proceed all the way to the end of the scale. You know, a majority of people will do that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it goes much higher if you have two teachers, one reading the question and one flipping the switches. The one reading, then you get like 92% obedience because the one reading the questions feels no responsibility for the one flipping the switches. And the one flipping the switches thinks the other one is responsible, and so the obedience rate is much higher.
Yeah, it's horrible. Yes.
Yes, it is. So I think that a lot of us think we couldn't do it, but in fact, a lot of us can in the right circumstances.
Yes, well, thank you so much.
All right, thanks for the call. That I guess is what as you suggest in the call. I suggest what. The difficult thing to understand, I suppose one could understand, one could imagine a torturer being someone who was a psychopath and got pleasure out of inflicting pain on another person. But it seems much more difficult to imagine the person who could say as you said, one of the torturers you talked to had said, it's nothing personal. It's just a job, and that they would be, they would take some satisfaction in a job well done. It's hard to imagine one would feel that way considering what the job is. That is, the job would be inflicting physical pain on another person.
Well, that's one way to define the job, but another way to define it is that you are saving lives. I'm saving lives on my side, and whatever information I get from this person will contribute to the preservation of civilization as I know it, this threat, be it religious or political, that exists out there in the society, or labor union or whatever it is, will be put down, and we will all be happier, and society will be much better off for what I'm doing today.
Well, I guess that gets us to the extreme hypothetical. The terrorist who puts an atomic bomb in the middle of downtown Chicago, and we have the person, and they know where it is. And the question is, what is it appropriate for us to do to that person to try to get him to tell us where the bomb is?
Well, let's say this. We torture this person, and we get nothing. So now, however, we know the guy is married, so maybe his wife will tell us. So why don't we torture his wife? I mean, it's the same number of people who are going to be killed whether we torture him or his wife. So let's torture his wife. And you know what? She dies before she tells us anything. Oh, no, what are we going to do? But he's got a daughter, 12 years old. I bet she might know. And if she doesn't know, she might know who else is in this group. So we better do the daughter. And you know what? We have security film of this guy. When he walked into this building, he nodded at one of the security guards. Let's get that security guard in here. We don't have much time. Let's torture that security guard and see if we can get anything out of him. Where do you stop?
Yeah, I think you, in as many words, say that that's one of the problems with using torture. It gets to be very seductive.
Yeah.
Well, let's continue talking with other people who are listening. Next caller up is in Belgium, Illinois, on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. I think we need to get to the basics of what we're talking about here, and that is just what is torture? You haven't really defined it. You know, there's a 6-year-old boy that might pull the wings off of a fly. That's a form of torture. All of us are capable of it in a strange sort of way, not just to somebody that's evil that we want to get information from. Isn't it pretty much just a human condition that we... Sometimes your wife tortures you to get the work done, you know? There's many, many forms of this.
Well, there is a formal definition of torture, which I will have to read to you because it's pretty complicated. In 1975, the United Nations defined torture as, quote, any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted by or at the instigation of a public official on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him or a third person information or confession, punishing him for an act he has committed, or intimidating him or other persons. Torture constitutes an aggravated and deliberate form of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. The definition goes on to state that the torture can be... It was revised and added. Discrimination of any kind was added to the list of motivations, and also it was clarified, sort of expanding the people who might do it, when such pain or suffering is inflicted by or at the instigation of or with the consent or acquiescence of a public official or other person acting in an official capacity. And that also includes people who are in terrorist groups. People recognize that guerrilla groups also torture, so they're also covered by the definition. The problem with the definition is that, a lot of work went into this, and it's a remarkable thing that the UN was able to agree on it. But the problem is that when you get to court, you have to, what exactly You have to prove what exactly is cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. When does pain or suffering become severe? And, you know, as you may have discovered, that certain kinds of pain are more intense for some people than for others. Some people, you can bend their finger back and it hurts an awful lot, and other people can bend their fingers back pretty far and it doesn't hurt. Our pain thresholds are different, and so this became a problem in the Belfast case, in which I write about in my book, when it went to the European Court. The European Commission on Human Rights ruled that it was torture, but it was appealed, and the higher court ruled that it was amounted to inhuman and degrading treatment, but not torture, because it didn't constitute severe enough suffering. And they made that decision without really any notion that the suffering was going to last for the rest of these people's lives. And as I point out in my book, quite a few of them died quite early deaths as a result, I think, of the torture.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I think I should introduce again our guest. John Conroy is a staff writer for the Chicago Reader and is author of a book that explores the dynamics of torture. The title is Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People. It was first published by Knopf in 2000 and is still available in a paperback edition that's published by the University of California Press, if you would like to read it. Questions are welcome. We have several. We'll try to get everybody in before we find ourselves out of time. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have someone in Chicago next in line one.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I guess I want to go back to the effect on the torturers. I find it really hard to accept that there's no effect on the torturers, and I'm wondering how the doctor in Greece did her study, and even in your conversations, because obviously these people have a distinct point of view after the fact, and most of them are in denial, just as we have even today veterans denying that there was torture in Vietnam. There's been documentaries about the Dutch experience in Indonesia and how they don't even want to use the same word they use for the Nazis, as the Nazis tortured the Dutch. They refuse to use that word in terms of their own actions in Indonesia. So you have a strong denial. So if you ask these people if there was an effect, I think that they would deny it. And that denial in itself and the ability to live a life in denial, I think, is one effect on the tortures. The other thing that I think probably you'd really have to struggle to find is that I suspect a lot of their actions are having unrealistic expectations of compliance with them, and I think that would be the effect on the children and the wife. A very harsh punishment for not complying, and possibly types of physical and sexual abuse, which I don't see these people saying to you, yes, that this is the effect, that I'm abusing my wife or my child. So I think that there really needs to be a very careful study, but I think that somehow, when people say there's no effect, I've never gotten the impression that they've looked into any of those aspects. And the only one I think that might be observable is perhaps a certain rigidity that these people might display.
Okay.
Well, go ahead, Mr. Conroy.
I'm not quite sure what the question is.
I guess
the question is simply that you said, this woman said, there's no effect on the torturers and that they're living normal lives, and the only possible thing is that they're politically isolated, and I find that very hard to believe for the reasons I just gave.
Well, there you have it. You find it hard to believe. I will only have to repeat what I said earlier, which is that it's the work of some psychologist named Mika Haritos-Fatouros, who studied the Greek torturers and found there's no evidence of sadistic, abusive, or authoritarian behavior in the Greek torturers before they entered the army. There was nothing in their family or personal histories to differentiate them from the rest of the nation's male population of their age at that time, and that years after they stopped torturing, they lived what seemed to be normal lives. I think that you are going to, you know, I have no doubt that there are torturers who feel remorse for what they did. I met some who did feel remorse for what they did. But I think that we all feel remorse for things that we have done, and we go on and live what seem to be normal lives. Some people feel remorse for things that are crimes against humanity, and some people feel remorse for things that are crimes of the heart or crime, you know, other crimes. And so I don't know how I, you know, you could possibly study this except by finding some group of, you know, you would have to. The woman, Mika Hritos Futuros, was lucky in finding, she was able to find one former torturer who brought in some of the others. And as a result, she was able to get something of a sample of a group of torturers and draw her conclusions. I think that, you know, as far as I know, it's the only study out there, and maybe there are others, but I don't think it's unusual. I think that Dr. Lifton finds it in the doctors at Auschwitz. He talks about this concept of doubling, being able to be, you know, to work at Auschwitz and feel sorry for yourself for having such a terrible posting. And then go home and be kind to your wife and kids, you know.
The question is the element of denial. I think that's why many of them, the ones who feel remorse, have admitted, but I think the overwhelming majority of them have denial about the degree, just as our society reacted by saying, well, this wasn't torture, or what they did wasn't that bad, it was just hazing. The level of denial, I think, is what enables these people, quote-unquote, not to have an effect, because they have never admitted to themselves what they've done.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, again, I thank the caller for the comments. I have some other people here I'd like to try to include. Let's go to Indiana for our next. This is line two. Hello.
Hello. A quickie. The lady had talked about the New York Review of Books article where the person said torture was... it was necessary, or in some sense could be done. I find that very difficult to believe, considering the political stance of the New York Review of Books. I have a subscription to it, and I don't remember reading anything like that, but that's basically anecdotal. But the question I had is something you brought up a short time ago, and which I've read in the New York Times and the Tribune and the New York Review of Books, is that torture is not effective. Anybody, you know, if, you know, when it's torture with a capital T, people admit to anything. And we mean, as always was concerned about when I heard about the thing at Abu Ghraib, is that, you know, are you a blah, blah, blah? Yes, I am. You know, I mean, what information, you know, how do they evaluate? And we're not dealing with dumb people. They must know that torture, you know, brings forth this kind of confession, you know, to get the pain to stop and stuff. So I ultimately think, I agree with the lady that just talked, that I think there's more going on than just, I go in at 8 o'clock and I leave at 4. I think we're dealing with a psychological type that could even be, in a sense, discovered through the test that the Army gives to people. Thanks a lot.
All right. I guess you can respond to that any way you like.
Well, I think that the psychological type is really not supported by what studies there are. There's another study of... by a psychologist named Molly Harrower, who studied the Rorschach records of Nazi war criminals 30 years after they were tried. And she reported that 10 experts could not distinguish the Rorschach test results of high-ranking Nazi war criminals from those of normal Americans. And Douglas Kelly, the psychiatrist who examined the Nuremberg defendants, who gave the test in 1946, also concluded that... he said, quote, such personalities are not unique or insane and could be duplicated in any country in the world today. Harrower, the one who did the test 30 years later, concluded that well-integrated, productive, and secure personalities are no protection against being sucked into a vortex of myth and deception, which may ultimately erupt into the commitment of horror on a grand scale. Milgram says the same thing. He says, with rapidity, with numbing regularity, good people were seen to knuckle under to the demands of authority and perform actions that were callous and severe. Men who are in everyday life responsible and decent were seduced by the trappings of authority, by the control of their perceptions, and by the uncritical acceptance of the experiment's definition of the situation into performing harsh acts. Mm. This is perhaps the most fundamental lesson of our study. Ordinary people, simply doing their jobs, without any particular hostility on their part, can become agents in a terrible destructive process.
There, on that note, we're going to have to end because we've used our time. If you want to explore the subject further, you can look for the book that we have talked about, Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, by our guest John Conroy. He's the staff writer for the Chicago Reader, also author of the book Belfast Diary, War as a Way of Life. And Mr. Conroy, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David.